In vandag se program gesels ek met professor Alex van der Heever. Hy is hoof van regeerkunde by die Universiteit van die Witwatersrand en hy het saam met verskeie professore van die mediese skool en van handel en regte het hy 'n artikel saamgestel oor die foute wat die regering gemaak het met die uitrol van die vaksineringsprogram. Hulle kyk ook na wat het ons geleer, die lesse wat geleer is en dan maak hulle aanbevelings vir 'n strategie oor wat die regering kan doen om te verhoed dat dieselfde foute in die toekoms weer gemaak word en dat dinge in die toekoms beter kan verloop met die uitrol van verdere vaksineringsprogramme. Dus vandag is my gas dan professor Alex van der Heever. Wat het julle genoop om hierdie artikel te skryf?
We were trying to evaluate the strategic approach that can be identified from the actions that government took during 2020 and 2021. The reason for doing that is to look at whether or not the strategic decision making made sense. And a lot of it didn't make sense. Now, we don't necessarily have access to any specific strategy that was being developed. What we're trying to do is to decipher the implied strategy. And when you look at a number of the decisions that were made, such as not engaging in bilateral negotiations in 2020, only engaging in bilateral negotiations when pressed to do so, eliminating the doses we received from AstraZeneca when they should still have been used, and now all the evidence is showing they absolutely should have been used, all of those decisions raise a number of questions about how people were thinking about the vaccine strategy that would be required in 2021. And one of the kind of findings is that government was apparently, at least in terms of what they're saying, apparently being excessively cautious about the decisions they were making. So on the one hand, suggesting that they would entirely put all their eggs in the basket of COVAX, this sort of multilateral framework, was always going to leave us short of vaccines. And we are aware that there was always going to be vaccine nationalism. It's going to happen. It's a predictable issue. So you have to, in your strategy, build that in as a contingency. And we clearly didn't. So there's a lot of decisions that weren't made because there was no decision making that was appropriate for the conditions of uncertainty that we were facing. And we feel that a lot of that could have been preempted. It's not the 2020 vision of hindsight. You make these decisions when you don't have complete information. You have no choice. So you have to build in contingencies for what might go wrong, what people are likely to do, and build that into your strategy. And none of that was really done.
Professor van der Heever, wat was die sleutelfoute wat gemaak is? Julle wys in die artikel uit dat die regering aanvanklik net op die COVAX-inisiatief staat gemaak is en op geen ander manier probeer het om vaksines te bekom nie en toe net op AstraZeneca en toe dit uitbom was hulle basies op hulle agtervoet.
So they were already on the back foot when they had no bilateral negotiations. So it wasn't that they didn't have any contact in 2020. It's just that they weren't really bothering to engage to conclusion in 2020, and that was very clear. So when there was a huge pressure put on government to get their act together very early in January of 2021, they suddenly began negotiations with AstraZeneca and with the Serum Institute of India. And within a week, they had effectively agreed to 1.5 million AstraZeneca doses. So that shows what can happen if you're actually getting on with the job. Now, think of how many doses they would have actually been able to access had they begun negotiations earlier. Then we always had the opportunity of accessing the Johnson & Johnson doses because up to 300 million could be finally produced, at least the fill and finish aspect. The vaccines will arrive in South Africa, be full and finished in South Africa, and re-exported 300 million doses in 2021. That's a huge opportunity. Government clearly did absolutely nothing to access a portion of that early on, during 2020 or early on in 2021. So again, only when pushed did they suddenly start to enter into these negotiations. And they were originally able to then get at least agreement on 11 million doses and then subsequently an additional 20 million doses. So suddenly, when you start to negotiate, you get doses. surprisingly. But the only problem is that they now come late in the day. So I think that the problem really was that it appeared as though the rationale for entering into the COVAX agreement only was an excuse for not doing anything for a very long period of time. As a strategy, it was incredibly high risk because COVAX is a recently created arrangement. And therefore, the possibility that COVAX would deliver us large supplies of doses early on in 2020, before we would go into the winter wave, it was impossible. It was not going to happen. And we might have, at this point, a few doses that we have received now from Pfizer via the COVAX agreement. Up until that point, we didn't receive anything from COVAX. And we turned down all the first tranches of COVAX because they were AstraZeneca. So the other decision that was appalling was to then not administer the AstraZeneca doses that we had. That was based on a very small trial that showed that it didn't prevent infection in the case of the South African variant, the so-called Beta variant. But now all the evidence is showing that it definitely prevents severe illness against most variants, and in particular against the variant that is currently driving our current wave. So all of those decisions were crazy. We gave away 1.5 million doses and potentially another 1.5 or up to a few million extra doses that would have come via COVAX in the early part of the year. We gave all of that away. So now we start in May with our general rollout. All of that was poor strategic decision making.
En toe die AstraZeneca projek misluk, toe sit asof die regering met sy hande langs sy sye staan, en as dit nie was vir mense soos professor Glenda Gray van die Mediese Navorsingsraad en groepe soos julle wat ernstige druk op die regering gesit het nie, het die uitrol van die Johnson & Johnson vaksin vir gesondheidswerkers sekerlik ook nog nie eens gebeur nie.
So we would have had no doses administered to the frontline healthcare workers unless the people responsible for the Johnson & Johnson trial didn't kind of pull strings and access their networks to get Johnson & Johnson to collect all of their trial doses that were available from around the world and have them redirected to South Africa so that we would have up to 500,000 doses for the frontline health workers. The benefit of that was, and that's not all our frontline health workers, by the way, or all of our health workers, but 500,000 doses is equivalent to 1 million doses of Pfizer because it's a single dose vaccine. So it's an incredibly important initiative. But yeah, that wouldn't have happened. If it were up to government, we would have only started in May.
Alex, dink jy die denkwyse het verander van aanvanklik waar gesoek is of gekyk is na 'n vaksin of vaksines wat geheel en al COVID kan voorkom tot vaksines wat die kans op ernstige siekte, hospitalisering en sterfte dramaties verminder?
So I think that that's the position we're in with pretty much all vaccines, is that they're not providing necessarily over time full protection against infection for mild illness. And that means that we're probably going to be facing a continuous circulation of the virus, regardless of the vaccines. There's some uncertainty about exactly how it would work out because we haven't had enough time. But what the vaccines do is they prevent severe illness. The ones that we're administering in South Africa have all shown very good results against severe illness. The ones that government seems to be wanting to go for, such as Sinovac and Sputnik, are a bit uncertain in relation to the variants in circulation in South Africa and are inconclusive. But the ones that we have are relatively good. So what could happen is that you would see what we see now in the United Kingdom, where you might actually have an increasing wave of infections, but the link between infections and severe illness and death has been broken. So now the hospitalizations are going down while the infections are going up. And that's kind of the scenario we would be facing. So the idea of herd immunity, where the more people have been infected or vaccinated, will actually create a herd protection from infection. And in that case, the virus would effectively die out. So we're not likely to face that. But the consequence of that for people who don't get vaccinated is quite important. Because in the case of herd immunity, the people who don't get vaccinated are actually implicitly protected by the people who are or have been infected or vaccinated, because the virus dies out. So even if you don't have the vaccine, you never get infected. But in a case where it doesn't eliminate transmission, vaccination protects the people who vaccinated, but not the people who are unvaccinated. And in fact, you're still likely to have quite significant rounds of community-based infection that is going to increase the possibility that unvaccinated populations will get infected without a doubt at some point. So if you don't get vaccinated, you don't have protection against severe illness. And the probability of being infected as society moves back to normality increases. So this is the two different scenarios. Herd immunity would actually protect the unvaccinated. But if you don't get herd immunity and just protection against severe illness, the unvaccinated are at risk. And I think that's not understood by many of the people who are choosing not to get vaccinated. At some point, they're going to get infected. And they are then at risk of severe illness and death.
Die volgende ding wat toe verkeerd loop, is die groot probleem met moontlike kontaminasie van die Johnson & Johnson vaksin wat in Kuberga vervaardig word. Toe word dit op ys gesit totdat daar met sekerheid gesê kan word of die bestanddele gekontamineer is of nie, en dit het ons dramaties teruggesit. En toe is daar nog die verdere stadige uitrol van die vaksineringsprogram.
So the vaccination program naturally would begin slowly as you kind of expanding vaccination sites and getting the logistics right. And this is kind of where, you know, a big criticism would be made about not rolling out with AstraZeneca in late January, February of 2021, because you would have actually got all the logistics sorted out very early on. So whenever you start, you're going to start slow and slowly build up. But what we were seeing was that until all this violence has emerged in South Africa, that in fact, what a lot of us really expected was starting to happen, which was that we were moving up quite fast toward achieving sort of 300,000 plus a day in terms of vaccinations. So we were, that the bottleneck wasn't actually going to be our rollout and our ground game. It was largely going to be our access to doses. We were achieving scale now quite easily as we expanded. With the private sector coming fully on board and fast expanding sites, it was just growing and growing. The EVDS system, which was set up for the Sasonki trial, was rolled out as part of the general registration process, and it had some hitches. But in essence, we did have a registration system, and we could actually use that to control the logistics for distribution. In other words, manage supply and demand to the different sites. I think we've done quite well in expanding, but the only issue is we began sort of late in the day, and we would have been at a much higher scale and vaccinated more people if we began in February as we should have.
Indien die vaksineringsprogram vroeër begin het, sou ons nie reeds met die aanvang van die derde golf 'n groot verskil kon gesien het, dat daar nie so baie hospitalisasies en sterftes sou gewees het as ons al verder gevorder was met die vaksineringsprogram nie. Met ander woorde, kon baie van die hospitalisasies en sterftes nou tydens hierdie derde golf nie voorkom gewees het nie. Het hierdie mense nie onnodig gesterf omdat die regering gedraai het om hulle vaksineringsprogram in werking te stel, as hulle nie die foute gemaak het wat hulle wel gemaak het nie?
Yes, this is the big problem, is that part of the reason, and I was part of the sort of group that got very, very angry with government for not getting its act together in December and then early January, and basically saying, where the hell are you? You know, what are you doing? Where's our strategy? Our main concern was that it was predictable that we were going to face a winter wave. It was one of those contingencies that was highly, highly probable. And it's contained in the letters that we had indicated. The winter wave happened in every country in the world. It's because the winter period is more high risk because people are indoors and transmission is much higher. And the problem when you combine that with more transmissible variants was always going to be a problem. So it raised us. If we had begun vaccinating in February and had scaled up, we probably would have had most of our high-risk groups protected as we went into that winter wave. As it was, even while we're vaccinating, people who get the vaccine are being infected too early for it to have an effect. And some of them are becoming severely ill, even if they've been vaccinated. They've got to be vaccinated early on. So yeah, I think that missed an important set of milestones. And that's very tragic. And what's also tragic is now even at Wits University in our own school, we have people who've died who should have been vaccinated early on in the year. And, you know, it really makes you angry because they were clearly identifiable as high-risk individuals and they should have been vaccinated and they weren't.
Is ons gereed vir 'n vierde golf?
I think we're going to see a continuous series of waves. I don't think that these waves are necessarily going to go away. The only question is whether you're facing a wave with a largely vaccinated population. So one of the consequences potentially of high levels of vaccination is that a wave actually then starts to contribute to improved immunity rather than to create illness and death. So if you've got 60 to 70% of the population vaccinated, you don't get severely ill, but every time you get some mild illness, you actually get more immunity. So it acts actually as a way of vaccinating you. Every wave will actually vaccinate, give you a booster shot potentially. And that's kind of what you're seeing in the United Kingdom at the moment, where this separation between severe illness and infection levels has occurred. They've got a rising infection levels. They've got a wave happening in the UK, but everybody's walking around without masks. They're attending Wimbledon in full capacity. They're doing that despite the fact that people are being infected. But in fact, all that happens is you develop some mild illness, you're effectively getting more immunity because of that infection, and it becomes less of a problem. But it's a problem for people in that community who are unvaccinated, because now vaccinated people can still transmit to you. And they won't get severely ill, but you can. So the issue is these waves will actually become less of a problem from a disease perspective the more we vaccinate.
Kan mens dan sê dat hoe meer mense gevaksineer is, hoe groter is die kans dat al hoe minder mense hospitalisasie sal benodig en sal sterf?
That's right, you'll get the equivalent of a cold.
Hoe moet ons verskillende lande se vaksinasionalisme verstaan? Gaan elke land nie maar in elk geval eerste wil omsien na sy eie mense nie, voordat hy vreeslik altruïsties optree en vaksines vir ander lande beskikbaar stel nie?
So first of all, vaccine nationalism is a predictable consequence of this, because politically no democracy is going to sit by and not vaccinate its population. And it's going to be incredibly difficult for that country to say, that we aren't vaccinating you because we're trying to protect people in some Central African country. That won't fly, no matter how altruistic and decent you are. You're not going to be in government very long if that's what you communicate. Your population expects you to protect it first before anybody else. Now, if you're sitting at risk of that behavior because the other countries are likely to be more assertive in accessing vaccines, you have to plan for that and make sure you get your foot in the door wherever you can. But to sit and do nothing would be a big mistake, which is what South Africa did in 2020. It did nothing. And that's a problem. If then to blame vaccine nationalism is just showing you're foolish, it was absolutely predictable. So going forward, we're still facing that. And we're potentially still facing that as a scenario in relation to booster doses, not just booster doses of the current vaccines, but booster doses of updated vaccines for the variants. So this is likely to be a situation where the new vaccines that are developed that incorporate the variants that we've seen, that account for them, are potentially going to be in short supply. They're probably going to be potentially, it's a contingency, not an absolute certainty, but it's probable that they're going to be an important issue in 2022. So the issue is, don't wait until 2022 to start thinking about this. Think about it now. The second issue is that we're likely to have a glut of the original vaccines without accounting for the variants. And they still are very effective against most of the variants. And in some cases, if you take AstraZeneca plus a Pfizer or a Pfizer and a Johnson & Johnson or a Pfizer and a Moderna, you can potentially deepen your immunity if you mix the vaccines, potentially. So you can still work effectively with these doses. So you should certainly be booking these doses and not waiting again forever before you get more doses booked. So, but what appears to have happened is that we don't appear to have negotiated for more doses than the ones that have been reported thus far for Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer. And that is potentially a problem because we're potentially going into a period where it'll be easier to get those vaccines than it was at the beginning of the year. So we shouldn't be sitting on our hands. So it's those two important strategies that I think need to be kind of thought through. Book doses now for updated vaccines for 2022 and get as many more doses as you can in 2021, taking into account that from July and into August, many of the advanced countries that had an advantage in booking doses are now going to be sitting with big surpluses. And it's quite possible that, you know, the two aspects that are important is the protection against infection and the protection against severe illness. And it's quite likely that we may not even need the updated vaccines. But what you do is you plan for the possibility that we do need them. It would be better that we're left with a surplus of doses rather than a deficit. And that's how you think about it as a problem. So part of why we were writing the article in that way was to say, think about this as a set of risks that you've got to take into account. You've got uncertainty. We don't absolutely know whether or not we will need an updated vaccine, but there's a strong possibility we will. So don't wait so that we only access them in 2023 after we've had waves of variants that are actually causing severe illness despite being vaccinated. That's really how we were orienting it, because the cost of these vaccines is nothing in comparison to the economic devastation they cause if we have severe illness as an outcome.
Is daar enige indikasie dat die regering hulle steur aan hierdie voorstelle?
Well, there's no evidence of it. Essentially, all we see is what we're being told about the vaccines that they have acquired up until now. So they've acquired the Pfizer doses and they've acquired a certain number of Johnson & Johnson doses. They seem to be pretty happy to sit on their hands and worry about the rollout now. I think that's a big mistake. They've also noted they try to appear to be keen to negotiate for the Chinese Sinovac vaccine instead of going for what will be the surplus doses of Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, and even Moderna as the United States goes into a glut. So we should really be looking at those potential vaccines because they've all been shown to be very effective against the variants we're facing. Now, then there's also the AstraZeneca vaccines. Now, although the Serum Institute of India is directing all of its production into India because of its crisis, AstraZeneca is not just produced in India. It's produced in many other settings around the world. We should be negotiating for those doses with AstraZeneca now as well. So for potential vaccines would probably be very useful. Moderna, AstraZeneca, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson. So really, I don't know what's happening with these particular groups, and I would certainly give them preference over Sinovac, which has very uncertain outcomes. And SAHPRA, the regulator, has only approved it for people in the sort of lower risk categories. And that's because they're very uncertain as to how much it protects against severe illness. They just don't have enough information. So they're rather giving it to people who are less likely to end up with severe illness. And that to me is not a good strategy. We need to basically be giving doses where there's good protection.
En wat van die Sputnik vaccine van Rusland?
So there's not enough data on both infections, all the levels of efficacy that you'd assess it. And so SAHPRA has not approved it as such. It's waiting for more information. There was very good evidence they would be rushing its approval, but they are not.
Sal julle wil sien dat die regering en dan sekerlik spesifiek deur die departement van gesondheid nader saamwerk met mediese raadgewers en navorsers soos julle en dan ook luister na hulle aanbevelings.
Well, I think they are working with experts and scientists. The only issue that has been raised and criticism is whether or not how that information is actually being used in decision making. Because there appears to be some inconsistency in translation from some sort of engagement to where some smoky room makes a final decision. Now, it's appropriate that government must take into a case a wide range of factors when making a final decision on a strategy, but you must be able to explain your decision at the end of the day, even if you deviate from what scientists have recommended. And it's important to note that the scientists themselves are not necessarily able to necessarily account for all the factors that are central to a final decision. But the facts that they present are important, and their intuitive position on contingent risks are quite important. In other words, we aren't certain about this, but we think this is a good way of thinking about this problem. That's quite important. And you might then balance that with people in other disciplines like economists or sociologists who might talk about what the sort of community impacts would be of restrictions or interventions. And then you make a decision based on that. What has been a concern is that government has been taking into account some other kind of issue that has nothing to do with the virus. And that's where a lot of people have raised concerns, where other kind of scores are being settled with certain industries that don't make sense, and effectively where they have abused the sort of scientific information that is being provided. And note that it's not all science, it's scientists giving advice as opposed to science. But they've suddenly said, well, we're taking into account the science, and we've decided to do something completely different to what the scientists have recommended. That's the problem. They've abused these advisory positions, kept the advisories out of the public domain, and then claimed they got the advice from these groups. It's quite clear all the way through that what they've done has not always been consistent with what reasonable people have advised who are from within the community. So there's a question as to how you structure how advice gets into the government process. There are many ways of doing that. I think the problem has really been just what is being taken into account in the final decision. And I think it's got better over time.
Ons wens almal dat die regering beter sal luister na die mediese raadgewers as dit gaan oor dinge wat ons gesondheid raak. Maar in samenwerking met al die ander sektore se raadgewers, sodat ons ekonomie nie in duie stort nie. Volgende week gesels ek oor waar jy begin as jy oorgewig is en jy wil gewig verloor. Tot volgende week dan, groete van my, Marie Hudson.